Mark Hagan of Penn State University. So here we have someone actually from Penn State University. Our previous speakers have been students at Penn State or had some kind of connection to Penn State. Now we've gone to the source. Mark is he's a professor in the famed geography department at Penn State, which is currently ranked number one in the country, I believe. And he's also the associate director of the Geovisualization Center there. Mark is very widely published and very widely admired in geographic information science. I think he's one of the stars of GI science. He has done work very, very broad from remote sensing and GIS, geocomputation, of course, geovisualization, all the way to areas such as philosophy of science. He has worked in application areas that range from natural resources all the way to epidemiology and social and human applications of the technology. He teaches in all of these different fields. Very widely involved in service to the GI science community. He's currently the North American editor of the International Journal of Geographical Information Science. He's on the editorial boards of the Annals of the AAG, Cartographica, Computers and Geosciences, Transactions in GIS, I could go on and on. He was educated in the UK and Australia. He took his science degree from the University of Leeds in the UK. And his doctoral degree from Curtin University in Australia. He's going to talk quite a bit about the GEON network and his work related to that. So I will let him move forward to talk about that. He is also, as if all of that is not enough, he's also the lead singer in a band called Greasewood Honeymoon. He's the lead singer and guitar player. Also has another Penn State geography faculty member in the band, so this is just too cool. So Mark, we're very glad that you're able to come to Oregon State, and welcome, and thank you for coming.
Thanks very much. I didn't know that music was going to get a mention. If I had, I'd have brought my guitar. Breezewood is a tiny little town it's on the way to Washington, D.C. from central Pennsylvania. And it's a town that chose to have the freeway go through it rather than go around it because it wanted to maintain its ability to sell coffee and gasoline to every trucker that passed through. So it's exactly the kind of place that you wouldn't want to go for your honeymoon, hence the band name Breezewood Honeymoon. I have to explain this when there are geographers around. And yet, sadly, if you type in Breezewood Honeymoon into Google, you will find there are honeymoon suites in Breezewood, which is just a glorified truck stop. Anyway, with that, I'll continue. So I'm going to talk today. This is the title that Dawn gave me. It's a pretty impossible talk that covers all of these things, but I'm going to give it a shot. Visualization, analytics, and spatial decision support in the Geosciences Network, or GEON. GEON, if you don't know, I'll introduce it more formally in a minute, but it's a new cyber infrastructure project that's been going for 4 or 5 years now, funded by the National Science Foundation. And I'm a co-PI in GEON. It's centered at the San Diego Supercomputer Center. And it's a brave new attempt, if you like, to redefine what science is in a very corporate kind of sense. And you'll get some idea of that and the things that I and the many people at Penn State and around the country who I work with, whose work I'm going to be showing today. So this isn't all my work. Many grad students, postdocs, and some folks at SDSC deserve a lot of credit for what I'm showing. I'll try and give appropriate credit where I can. Thought I'd start with a joke. I was going to take a chance on making a joke at the expense of geographers and geologists, since both in the room, but this is kind of relevant to what comes later. So there are three academics on a train going through the wilds of Scotland, and they look out of the window of the train and they see this single black sheep silhouetted against the landscape, and they all look out of the window and point at the sheep and wonder what this might mean. And the geographer looks at the sheep and recognizes some of its key qualities and tries to infer using induction things about sheep, and it goes something like this. The geographer says, well, Ah, that sheep, oh look, all sheep in Scotland are black. And the other two look at the geographer a little bit sideways and, you know, how does that work from that single observation? The geologist steps up, and field geologists particularly, in my experience, are very good at working out stories or theories. And so the geologist says, a theory about the sheep. Now, sheep in Scotland are dark because the landscape is dark and the sky is dark, and it's the best camouflage colour a sheep could be. And the mathematician says, I'm sorry, but you're both wrong. What this shows me is that in Scotland there exists at least one field that contains at least one sheep that is black on at least one side. Now, there's a reason for that little joke. And the reason is this. Apart from the fact we all think differently, and we use different ways to think about the world and different experiences, there's also a richness in that diversity that's an important part, an overlooked part, of the process of trying to formalize and regiment science that often goes hand in hand with a cyber infrastructure, and you'll see why I mean that as I go through my talk, because part of my talk is about what you might do about that. So cyber infrastructure is just like ordinary infrastructure, it's just like drains, power lines, and it's designed to be the stuff that supports science into the next generation. Here. And what makes it different is that a blue ribbon panel, some NSF scientists and visionaries have tried to envision a kind of science where we don't keep repeating each other's work, where we share equipment more effectively and resources, where we share our results more effectively, where a community moves forward as a community rather than a bunch of individuals working on their own. And so to facilitate that, to try and collect data sets together into national and international collections, and methods, and workflows, and web services, and knowledge, and to allow that to be accessed and contributed to and utilized from wherever you happen to be, to have access to all the high-powered computing, all the high-powered machinery, and the knowledge and the data from wherever you happen to be in the world. And it's a brave vision, and it's a difficult one to bring about, because not only are you having to invent some new computational algorithms and infrastructure, you're having to also reinvent a way of doing science. The second part is harder than the first, and the first is hard enough. Anyway, this is GEON, the Geosciences Network, or geongrid.org, and this is the front page. It shows you some of the things that GEON does. So it has massive data collections, and it has some tools that you can use, and web services and workflows. It also has some knowledge representation, some ontologies in there that help you register and understand one data set from your own particular perspective. There's stuff you can't see there. There's a big infrastructure of hardware, massively parallel computers and data stores throughout the country, and now actually also internationally too. I'm trying to make GEON work overseas as well. And there are networks of sensors. There are big simulation programs and experiments in silicon. And there's also a community, a growing community of practitioners who are more important than all the actual stuff. And they need representing too. And so GEON is all of those things, as you might imagine. That's the actual geography of the Geosciences Network, some of the major nodes in the country. There's one a minor node at Penn State, there's a major one at USGS, some of the national science labs. This is really the TerraGrid, if you know anything about national cyber infrastructure. This is the TerraGrid with some geography and geology added in on the top. Now, my talk is aimed at the higher levels of the cyber infrastructure services that you might expect. So if you're going to build a national cyber infrastructure, you need a distributed computing platform, and you need to have protocols for who can put data where and who can get at this, and how you run a remote application on a supercomputer and get the results and visualize them. You need all of that stuff. And it's a little bit like web services, only a little bit more involved, but not too much more involved. GEON uses a standard called Globus, if you know anything about cyber infrastructure. On top of that, I think, come the more interesting things of Well, if several geologists are giving me their data, let's say they're mapping geologists, some from Canada, some from the USA, they use different schemes. Those schemes are predicated on different understandings of the Earth. How do I integrate them if I want to do cross-border work on, I don't know, groundwater or stability or minerals or whatever it might happen to be? It's a non-trivial problem. Just having access to data doesn't make it useful. You have to be able to integrate it with how you understand the world. And so Geon's invested a lot of time building mediation strategies for taking the schema of one scientist, the schema of another scientist, and trying to build some overarching schema to which they can both be registered. Examples will follow to try and illustrate that. Then there's some work on visualization. I'm going to show you some work that we didn't do at Penn State, but I think is really cool on earthquake simulation on the San Andreas Fault. And some work we did at Penn State, which is on visualizing knowledge. Visualizing the knowledge that underpins this science community. Visualizing how one scientist might understand the world and comparing it to how another might understand it, or at least trying to. And then there's the stuff on workflows and analysis methods. One of the ideas behind cyber infrastructure is that not only do you publish your results and publish your paper, but you try and publish the stuff that goes in between the two. So usually it's kind of a mystery. What connects the data to the publication? There's a lot of implicit knowledge. There's methods that you probably can't get at. But if you could capture analysis workflows and make those a publishable thing, and if you could capture understanding, conceptual understanding, and publish that as well, then you begin to be able to capture more of the science process. You're able to question that science process, refute it, or prove it for yourself, or try something different. And the science process becomes richer. So analysis and workflows is really quite an important part of making science more defensible, more refutable, more communicable to other people, and preserving what it is you've done. So I'll show you a little bit of work that we've done on that too. So first of all, data integration. Now, I'm going to have to flip and flop a bit between themes. I apologize in advance. It seems like I'm changing tack rather quickly, but I'll try and frame the transition so you understand where I'm going. For those of you who haven't been following what's happening in data integration, a buzzword that's come along in the last 5 to 10 years is the O word, or ontologies. Really what it means is a formalized database schema, perhaps with richer relationships and constraints in a data model, that tells you that this particular geological unit is from this particular geological type, which is from this particular model of geological evolution or time period. So it's a way of understanding a bit more about the things that are in the databases by connecting them with higher level ideas. Now, if you can do that between multiple science communities, then perhaps that's a way of integrating the data more effectively. Rather than just taking two tables and trying to match the names of the headers of the tables, look at what those tables say they describe and try and find the best matches, or the closest way of integrating the data, or perhaps finding that you can't integrate the data. So here's a motivating example. This is from some work that the Geological Survey of Canada did, and it's provided to me by a colleague of mine, Boyan Broderick, with which I did some of this work. And it shows a classic problem in geological mapping, but it could be any kind of mapping. You go out in the field, you take a team of field scientists with you. They're all experts in what they do. They have keys, they have methodologies, all in place. They look at the same data, the same pieces of Earth, and yet, when you zoom in on the boundary of two map sheets, you see all these categorical disagreements. So the geometry pretty much fits, but the categories often don't. What does that tell you about the process of interpretation, and how do we reconcile these kinds of differences? Well, ontologies would say, let's find a common denominator between this and this. Let's go up the generalization hierarchy until we find a point where these things agree. And let's see if we can then call it the point of agreement rather than the two specializations of it that are different colors there. And you lose some information by doing that, but you gain interoperability. So this is just one example. So GEON has invested a lot of time working with the main scientists to try and capture some of their understanding. And it's been very interesting for all involved. People who make maps understand that map making in the field is a very subjective, interpretive thing. But other branches of geology and computer scientists generally don't understand that. But what becomes obvious very quickly is that different communities of field geologists have different ways. You can see three ways there: fabric, genesis, and texture, of categorizing the things they see in the field, leading actually to a different basis conceptually from which they create their categories by which they classify the things they see in the world. So actually the problem of connecting these things together is somewhat more difficult than it might appear at first instance. But anyway, working with some of the geoscience experts in both the USA and Canada, GEON has produced these kinds of taxonomies, and it's now trying to find ways of connecting these different views of the Earth together so you can translate a Canadian data set as if it were classified by a USGS geologist. And so we build these into shared schemas that integrate these various perspectives. This is work from Krishna Sinha at Virginia Tech, to allow us to interoperate or integrate those data sets more convincingly. And when we've captured that expertise, the glue that joins those perspectives together, then we can actually integrate maps on the fly. So you can take maps into the GEON portal. This is actually a tool in the GEON portal. You take two maps, and then there's a matching service to allow you to match together the fields in those tables and produce a map from a combined map from the perspective of just one of the maps. So again, you can take maps made by two different organizations and choose to show one map as if it were made by the other organization. As close as you can hope to with this kind of matching technology. It's not perfect by any means, but you can get some of the way there. And this is the work of Kai Lin at SDSC. And you can use that mapping service. It works with ArcGIS data formats, and you can use it to interoperate two different classification schemes by making rules that join them together. So now I'm taking a transition away from knowledge just for a moment towards simulation, just to show you some of the stuff that GEON is doing with simulating large-scale geoscientific experiments. I'm going to go back to knowledge in visualization in a minute. One of the things that GEON has done, in fact, one of the things GEON is getting famous for, or infamous for, are its models of earthquake simulation in Southern California. I thought I'd show you an example of one of those. This would be a good time to get sound working. I didn't think it was working. Okay, didn't seem to work before. GEON has built these models that they run on massive computers to simulate, as well as we are able to right now, ground movements and potential impacts of 7.7 more or thereabouts earthquakes along different points of the San Andreas Fault, looking at how the fault would propagate and then trying to convey the severity of that to the public, and of course has alarmed lots of people in the process. I'm going to show you just an example of this. But what's interesting about this is it uses a combination of some of the best geoscientific and geophysical analysis that we have and modeling, in situ instruments, massive scale computers for processing, and then also massive visualization for rendering these models. So it's a combination of some of the stuff that GEON has done along with people in the CalIT Institute at San Diego. I think that should be making a noise now, Dawn. If it won't make a noise, I can tell you what's happening. These are earthquake zones. Sorry, these are seismic stations and monitoring and San Andreas Fault down there. And then the model will come up in a moment when it zooms in and show 224 nodes, that computing nodes that were used to process this simulation over, as you can see there, 600 kilometers more or less. GEON has run a whole series of these, propagating the fault to the east or to the west to look at the difference. And here are some of the ways that this has been visualized to try and explore it. So here you can see ground versus surface disturbance and movements. I don't know. Can you see that well? Analyzed through time, and of course the LA Basin traps a lot of that residual energy. It's bouncing around in there minutes after the earthquake has stopped. And of course that's a scary thing to see when you see it like that. Now this shows, as you can see, an earthquake propagating to the west, and they've done a lot of simulations with it propagating to the east as well. And of course, massive vertical exaggeration to bring the point home that the mountains are being ripped asunder by this terrible act. But it's evocative nonetheless. It's a bit Steven Spielberg, but it's okay. And here you can see, and it zooms in on Los Angeles to see it bounce around in there on that bowl of sand.
The system volume may be down. The system volume turned off.
Okay, it really doesn't matter. I've heard it before, so I'll try and narrate it as best I can. And there's a long, pregnant pause here while you think about the human scale of the disaster in LA. And I guess, really, it is no laughing matter. It's a little bit overplayed here. Yes, right. The amount of computational power you need to run this model for visualizing is enormous. It took 4 days simply to extract the data from the model after it had run to be able to visualize it. And now you're seeing a sort of profile. I like that visualization where it splits the earth, lets you look inside it, but still shows you what's happening on the top. I'm not an expert in earthquakes, but the difference when you run the simulation the other way is quite dramatic in terms of where the energy goes and what ends up getting wiped out. And I have more of these on my computer, so if you want to see a comparison of east versus west propagation, I'll happily show you that when we're done. So there are earthquake scenarios. That's some of the business of GEON. But here's another aspect of GEON. This is the current GEON catalogue. This is what happens if you visualize the GEON catalogue. It uses AGI metadata, if you know the AGI topic map for geosciences. It uses that to tag data sets to show what kind of thing they show, or where they might be relevant, or for what. And when you visualize these, each as a node in a graph, you get these massive spaces of resources. And so it's using a kind of upper-level ontology, a kind of formal description of what geosciences is, to mark up with metadata the various geoscience data resources that GEON has. And you can see, really, what you get is a galaxy or a universe of things that are very difficult to navigate around. And you could build a search interface that used keywords or a visual one like this, and it would be difficult to find what you wanted. Finding what you need in a massive collection of data library is often difficult, particularly if it's not well documented, as most of our data sets are, or you don't really understand what was done to produce it. Here's another view of GEON. This is actually the topic map areas from the tags that are used. These are each of the AGI theme numbers, the various tags to organize geoscience research. And you can see again that you really can't navigate your way through this kind of a structure. And I put this up to try and show you that you need more than just a kind of top-level description of a domain to be able to find things that are useful and know how to use them. You need far more than just a couple of tags here or there. You need to understand more about the process by which data sets were made, how they might be used, to understand if they're appropriate for you, and really to be able to share them effectively. So there's more to this than just metadata. Ontologies aren't enough. And apart from, there are some classic problems with ontologies. You have to get the main scientists to agree on them. And in my experience working with GEON, that's been extremely difficult. They can agree on the sort of very, very top-down description of a particular problem, but they get two or three concepts into the hierarchy, and there's arguments and people saying, well, I never knew, you didn't understand what that means. I've always known it means this. And I remember being at a dinner meeting where one of your guest speakers, Randy Keller, was arguing with another eminent geophysicist, and they got two levels down in the ontology, and then they were fighting over over terms that they thought they shared. The other thing about ontologies is it tends to lock you into a rigid way of thinking about the earth. If you've got to describe everything you have in terms of this particular way of categorising what's important in your discipline, then actually that acts as a break to discovery. And you might ask yourself, well, how would this have helped or hindered plate tectonics? If plate tectonics as an idea had come around, but there weren't any tags in the AGI upper ontology, would it ever have been accepted as an idea? Would there be more inertia rather than less in our thinking and in our communities? So this is a problem. Too top down, too static. It's too difficult to mark up the resources that we have so that they are registered to an ontology. So there are many difficult problems. But the one that gets my goat the most is this, that just like those scientists on the train at the beginning, we actually all understand the world in a different way. Sometimes those differences aren't useful, but sometimes they are. The intellectual diversity that we bring is actually a really helpful part of the process of science. And if we try and standardize too much, I think we will remove that diversity, and that could be a very dangerous thing for the way we do science. So what we tried to do is to contextualize some of those resources that Gion has with other ways of thinking about what things mean or what knowledge is. So that's involved me learning something about the philosophy of science, going back to from sort of Aristotle through to John Sower with Alfred North Whitehead and C.S. Peirce on the way, and trying to understand how it is that we construct meaning and what are carriers of meaning in science. And so there is the sort of top-down formal semantics of how we understand the domain. There's the bottom-up, what we do and who we do it with and where we do it and why we do it. And they meet somewhere in the middle, which is where meaning is constructed. And so we tried to capture some of that by adding in to these massive databases of resources and ontologies some of the more situational aspects of who's doing the work, what tools are they using, who's using the work that's being produced. So social networks, networks of citations and publications, ways of understanding how these people and resources connect together that help us understand things that are in Gion. And tools for navigating too, so you can present displays that are thematic like this one. So here I'm visualizing concepts in the same way you might think of visualizing data, trying to use good visual variables that promote pop-out for the things that are interesting, shapes and sizes and themes in the visual variables to promote ideas. And yet these ideas are about knowledge and about people and about relationships and methods and tools, not just about data and not just about ontological or top-down knowledge. And so you can browse top-down or you can browse bottom-up. It's a little bit like Amazon.com, if you've used Amazon.com. And you can understand the world by making a taxonomy of all the books or music that's ever been published. But you can also understand the world by a recommender system that says, oh, well, if you like this, you're probably going to like that too, because 8 out of 10 people. Well, imagine that in science. Okay, 8 out of 10 geologists use this tool with this data set. Would you like to try that too? Now, in the absence of any knowledge, any real inside knowledge, that would actually be helpful, I think. You might want to know, sure, how does this model or this data set fit with someone's understanding of the world? But it would also help you if you knew who had used it and what they'd used it for. That would tell you a great deal about the utility of that product from your own perspective, whether you trust it, because someone you trust has used it already. And so what we're really saying here is that we have syntax for encoding information, we have semantics for imposing some top-level meaning on information, but we also have pragmatics, the situational aspects of who's doing what with what, with which tools and how, that also, in fact, add a massive amount to what things mean. And in a discipline like ours, where meaning is constructed by people working together to understand the world, to hypothesize conceptual structures that help them to to interpret what's going on. Pragmatics is an underrepresented but extremely important aspect of what things mean. And so we're trying to build systems that incorporate pragmatics as well as semantics. I'm going to go back to the example I showed you at the beginning, because the punchline is that in fact these two maps are made by the same geological team. So this is the support of the old adage that if there are n geologists, there are at least n plus one opinions. And I apologize if I offend by that joke, but I think that's right, and I think that's actually one of the good things about geology, not one of the negative things. And so this is the same team mapping 6 months earlier, and what we did actually was look at some of the social dynamics and the geographical proximities of the people and the places interacting doing the mapping. And what this shows you, for example, is that you can look at what a geologist is seeing in the field through time and what they're calling it. So this looks at a particular category, both within a particular geologist's mind and between geologists, and it looks at how stable the outcome is given what's going in. So in is going all the attributes that the person is observing, the methods and the keys are static, and what's changing is the outcome. So what's happening as these people work together, and of course there's dynamics going on. Here we have the stubborn field hand who's not going to change their opinion, flat lying. Here we have the rookie who's trying to find the person whose work they admire. And here we have a person who's not converging to the group norm. They're out to lunch. And what this tells you, in fact, is that the work of this person and this person are converging at about week 7. Don't trust anything they did before then. But after week 7, they're probably consistent. And it says also, you need to find some other team for this guy to work on, because he's not going to work effectively with these guys. He's not on the same wavelength. This kind of understanding shows you that what we take as objective truth often in these maps is really a dynamic and contested knowledge that's evolving through time as people are in the field doing their work. And this is the richness and the diversity and the challenge of representing geoscientific knowledge as it maps onto data. You can't understand the map unless you know when it was made and by whom, and that might give you an idea whether particular units are likely to be right or not, or at least consistent. John Sower, a famous computer scientist and also a philosopher, talks about the problem thus, and I went a little bit too fast there. We each make predictions about the Earth based on crystalline theories that we create for ourselves or that we model in our computers. But these theories come from the soup, the ingredients of which are not immediately obvious to us. So some of the ingredients in the soup might be that I used ArcGIS or I used a particular data set that's identifiable. Other ingredients, the herbs and spices that you can't see, are how I was feeling that day, who's paying for this funding, where I was educated, all those kinds of things, which really do colour meaning, and we fool ourselves if we think otherwise. And so the problem is that the predictions and the crystalline models are very transparent, but when someone else makes a prediction that we want to compare our predictions to, maybe it's based on a different soup. So if we could understand the soups better, we could understand how to make the predictions integrate better. So this is really the problem of knowledge integration and the problem of data integration. If we try and integrate these two maps or these two predictive models of whatever it is, if they're really based on different soups, then they aren't necessarily commensurate. So what we tried to do is build a knowledge portal where we can construct this kind of intricate web of meaning by taking some ideas that we thought we could operationalize. This is what we call a knowledge nexus after the work of Alfred North Whitehead, a famous US mathematician and philosopher, famous for saying that knowledge keeps no better than fish. But also really good systems philosopher. And some of these ideas are hard. The ellipses are things that we can probably represent quite well now, the clouds are things that we aren't very good at representing, but meaning is somehow all of that together, and you can start cutting these strands in this web, and at some point meaning collapses, or at least from your particular perspective meaning might collapse. So what can we represent and how can we represent it to allow people to understand what's in the Geon infrastructure and use it more effectively? Well, fortunately for me, I picked an example here. This runs live on a little demo I can show you afterwards if you like. I picked actually, this is the work of Bill Pike at Penn State and now at PNNL, just up the road. I picked the work of Randy Keller, just by coincidence. He's coming here soon, March, to talk. And this is an insight into Randy Keller's head. So Randy Keller made a very famous map that's being used in geoscientific analysis, particularly in relation to tectonics and stability. And here it is. Here's the concept map that represents the real map. So it's what was in his head, the things that were important to him when he made this seismic velocity model and then map. And that's it represented in our Codex knowledge portal. So it shows the conceptual ideas that went through Randy's head. But we should be able to flip that and say, okay, enough ontology. Now I want to be more practical and focus on how did he make the map? So by just flicking a button, you can change the perspective in this display. So now it shows you the data sets and methods that went into that model. A completely different way of understanding what it actually is or what it means. It's not top down, but it shows you programmatically how it was made. So you could reconstruct or refute the analysis based on this model or run it for yourself. So it's a workflow. But it tells you what the thing means in the sense of how it was created. Here's another view. This shows you the user community for that thing. Who has used it? You could also have the community for who has made it. So this tells you something about the social dynamics and you might decide if you trust this or not by looking at who has used it before, and perhaps these people in the future would be able to recommend certain data sets that they've used and not recommend others or evaluate them a little bit like peer review on the fly, so that you'd have some confidence in the user community of Randy Keller's model. I hope I didn't misrepresent him there. So that's part of trying to make better use of knowledge. Now, in a cyber infrastructure, you've got people accessing from essentially all over the world, coming through a single gateway to this knowledge, data, methods, workflows, high-performance computing system. So actually, you can monitor who's using what, who's working with what. There are some issues in there about academic privacy, but there are also some very useful emergent knowledge structures in there, just like the ones that Amazon.com uses when they market to you. Let's show this very, very briefly, just to try and bring some of these ideas together. So what you have now is some work that we're doing in my lab right now, where we're trying to actually take the knowledge structures and connect them to the data that they describe or that they were derived from. More carefully. So one of the problems that I've noticed too in the way we use ontologies and these sort of formal models is they get disconnected from the data. So if I'm, as I am here, doing remote sensing, this is New South Wales coast, and these are forest habitats in the New South Wales coast, if I'm trying to understand those forest habitats, then I'm constructing categories that help explain the things that are important to me on the ground. And I'm doing that, in this case, by looking at the data, scatter plots and parallel coordinate plots, to look for the emergent structures and clusters that help me to divide up this complex data space and make concepts that represent it. So this is the process of actually trying to join together the knowledge and the data. So now what we're trying to do is build systems where you sketch out your ideas, you try and impose them on the data that you have. And if you don't like the results, in other words, they don't help you to say what you want to say about the world, then you start to revise those concepts and categories. You look for where things don't separate well in these scatter plots and parallel coordinate plots. And you refine your concepts, the categories, till you have a model that works better to explain the thing that you want to represent. So that process can be captured. We can know that this concept Where's the one that we actually created rather than, yeah, so upper slope and lower slope wet are ideas that we had to try and pool things together to help us to explain what was going on. So we can show and remember the connections between those concepts and their exemplars in the world. We can represent the places in the world that get classified according to that concept, and we can represent the places in the world that cause us to refine our model. And myself and Roy and Broderick are starting to do this with geoscientific data, trying to model where, what geologists see and which are their exemplars for certain kinds of structures. And then which are the, so they're the formative examples from which their conceptualization was based. And then look at what other examples cause that to change or to move or to be refined. So now you have a much richer representation of what those concepts or categories really mean. This is something we haven't finished, but that's something we're trying to do. So this is the case of the geological field mappers looking at the relationships between what we can see in the data space, it's clustering, and the taxonomies that we have, and how those two things are kind of held in balance by the science that we do. We modify the taxonomy where it doesn't help us say the things we need to say about the Earth and the feedback between them. So we're trying to make those connections work. So you can compare possible strategies for categorizing the data, remember the category scheme, and have it attached to its formative examples, and then pass that on to somebody else. So this is two different land cover examples, again, back from Australia, two different ways of categorizing that landscape. They separate well or don't separate well on certain ideas, so useful in different circumstances. So just finally to finish, going back, the third topic now was analysis and workflows, and this is just to show some of the work that we've been doing in the GeoVista Center on capturing the actual process of doing an investigation, wrapping it up and deploying it as something that you can keep open, reuse, refute, use again, and publish in the same way you publish your papers. So this is a system called GeoVista Studio that I lead at Penn State, and it's really a visual programming environment. It's like having a workbench. You drop components in, you connect them together visually, and that constructs a program for you. Once you have your program working and it does what you want it to be able to do, you can actually deploy it as an application. So you can make an application just of the things you've used and deploy it on the web as a workflow for others to try. And you can drop in components that you didn't write, and it has some cool Java technology for joining things together. If any people are interested in that, I can talk to you about it afterwards. Whole sets of components that do different modeling and analysis visualization tasks. It works by connecting Java beans together at runtime into intricate, or not intricate, workflows that can then be saved and redeployed. So this is one mechanism by which you can remember what you did, you can publish it, you can have others refute it or applaud it, and you can contribute it. And we've worked a lot recently at trying to help it easier, make it easier to construct workflows by looking at the kinds of tasks that scientists do and how they move around between the activities and what tools support various activities. So trying to break out of the sort of menu system, stovepipe mentalities we have for the tools we use right now, are trying to build systems that encompass conceptual ideas rather than implementational ideas, rather than this does overlay analysis. Think instead about the scientific aspects of the activity, and to be able to put tools around here to recommend to people what they should use. I don't really want to go into that in detail, but just to show that we're trying to think about that. Here's an example that's not a workflow for doing science, but it's a workflow for doing education. This is a concept map showing the idea of map projections. And you can navigate around this to learn about map projections. And just like in a workflow, you can connect components together that make contracts with each other. I'm going to do this and then pass it on to you, and you're going to do that, and I'm going to pass it on to that. You can do the same with educational components too. You can define an educational component that has its own pedagogy, that has its own workflow and connection points, and you can assemble them into workflows that make curricula too. This is some work I'm doing with the people from the Digital Library for Earth Science Education at Colorado. And here's an example, I don't want to go into this, but this is some new work in visual analytics where we're, again, trying to make connections between data and concepts, concept maps here, and ontologies and maps and data. And this is looking at the emergence of a possibly new vector-borne disease based on some cases that crop up, and then using the semantics of the concept map to go find relevant resources on the internet, looking at how they match with the symptoms and the progression of the disease and the likely vectors, realizing that they don't match, and then trying to look for other resources on the internet that match the symptoms and the etiology of the disease. So you're using concepts and formal models of diseases with geographical data and the emergence of a disease over space and time to search for the resources that you might need to identify what this disease is. This is just a scenario that we built that actually identifies a new vector-borne disease that's endemic in Australia coming to Pennsylvania. So I should end there. I'm going to end just with a little bit of a summary on cyber infrastructure. I've shown you some of the technical aspects of the grid and some of the services involved to make that work. We've looked at some of the conceptual problems of representing what it is we put in the grid, what it means to us, and what it might mean to someone else who takes it and uses it. What I haven't talked about is the sociological aspects of that. I'm going to leave these as things for you to ponder. One of the biggest challenges with cyber infrastructure is how do you sustain it? It's a 5-year funding cycle in NSF for GEON. It runs out next year. Should it continue? How does it continue if it should continue? All the geoscientists who are in GEON think it absolutely should continue. All the ones who are outside probably think, no, let's get rid of that and have some more money back in that NSF directorate. And I quite understand that. How do you make it sustain so that it becomes a community resource, like a shared library, that's useful, that doesn't formalize the way we think about geoscience too much? Too much constraints, too many constraints is a bad thing. How do we make this a successful adoption? There are opportunities, particularly for the younger academics, but there are risks too. People can see what you did, and perhaps you don't like that. Perhaps that gives away some of your academic secrets. If you already hold the best data and the best algorithms and they're private, then you might have resistance to this because it's going to erode some of your power. So cyber infrastructure is seen as changing the power structures in academia in quite strange and sometimes threatening ways. We've had all kinds of different reactions from scientists who've seen what the knowledge portal can do. From I won't use that, it will give away all my ideas, to what a fantastic idea, I'll be able to reuse people's science more effectively. The recognition, the opportunity to recognize different contributions. At the moment we reward articles and grants, but we could reward good models and good data sets and good ontologies because they help other people to understand earth science better. So a cyber infrastructure gives you the opportunity to know how much the things that you contribute impact your domain, because we know how many times it's been used, by whom and for what. So by knowing that, you can measure your impact. So you might go to your dean and say in your promotion and tenure profile, I contributed this Krigging method that's been used by 15,000 different people. And that is a massive impact on my domain. And I can see some of the younger people in the audience thinking, yeah, right, that's what I want. And I must admit, I have a lot of sympathy with that. GEON actually has a sociologist within the grant watching the scientists as they try and do their ontology creation and fight these battles. It's very interesting to see what they see when they see us arguing about rock types. So thanks very much for your attention. I'd be delighted to take questions and suggestions too. And if you want to know more, I'd be happy to point you to resources you might be able to use afterwards. So thanks for your attention. just add before questions, thanks very much to Dawn and to many people in this department who spent time with me today. I was very impressed by the way people were able to make time, and that meant a lot, so thanks a lot. So questions, please. Yeah.
On your little graph that showed the three geologists with, you know, the one who was steady, the one who was converging, the steady one, and the one who was converging. Is that just a schematic, or is the vertical axis, you know, numbers?
That signifies sort of mean average distance between the clusters of the attributes that they saw and the thing they called it. So you might get stimulus going in all these variables you're collecting, and they're all collecting exactly the same variable, but the outcome is different. So what we're doing is measuring the stability of the input vector to the output concept. By doing a kind of minimum distance clustering technique.
Based on what their field
load? They use a system called Field Log, which is a Canadian system that Boy and my collaborator built. So everything that they collect.
Computerized
field logs plus the assays from when they took samples as well. So it's about a 200 dimensional data set that's effectively normalized field notes. And we take that and we feed it into minimum distance clustering method that we had to develop to try and show these differences. And you can see some interesting things, and we've looked at the difference between, well, what happens if they all look at the same thing at the same time, and let's have a look where this person was mapping at the time when they were divergent. Maybe it's a different example in the upper left-hand corner of that quad, which means they're seeing something slightly different, or they might be interpreting it slightly different. So we looked at all those kinds of dynamics. What role does geography play? What role does time play? What about the mixture of different kinds of people? Is this a new person going in trying to gain exemplars or prototypes? Or is this an old field hand? Or is this a person whose category seems to be still in flux? And we think we've been able to identify some of those trends in those lines over time. There's a paper coming out in... There's a new version in an ontology journal that we just had published, and there's one in Computers and Geosciences that looks at an early version of some of this work. You'll be able to find it. It takes you through the actual technique and the math if you wanted to follow it in more detail and how we normalize the data. Yeah?
The tools that you're talking about, the GeoGrid and the GeoVista, are those accessible? Are they?
GeoGrid is completely public. All you have to do is register as a user. The Geon workbench and the Geon portal, that's something you can go to right now, www.geongrid.org, will take you straight there.
What is it called?
Geon.net.
You can actually use it now, what kind of account can actually put it?
Yeah, you can use the models, you can get the data, you can use the ontology mediation service. I would have to say that the amount of really good geoscience in there is pretty small, but the amount of enabling infrastructure is pretty good. So it's still at the level where we're getting data and sharing data, and there are a few workflows in there, and a few models, and a few simulations, but not much. The stuff I showed from GeoVista, yeah, GeoVista Studio, you can download that, type GeoVista Studio into Google. The other stuff I showed, the knowledge portal, I have to show you where that is, because it's not something that's public right now, but most of the concept graphs and ontologies are done with a system that we've built called Concept Vista. Again, if you type that into Google, you'll be able to download it.
What about the content providers up in there? Like that, do you connect to the people who are in this system, or is it open to the anyone?
If you provide content, usually you will provide it in terms of open access. But there are some things in Geon that have controlled access. So you can build actually a closed community within Geon. And you can do that actually within the knowledge portal I showed you too. So you can choose to share your knowledge and your data with your immediate colleagues, but not to share with everybody. You still have to trust that the system isn't hackable or that someone isn't looking, some systems administrator isn't giving away the secret. So there is an element of trust.
For example, right now I talked about Geon, I want to look up the data. So your Geon coming connect database on the grid.
It's connected to
not actually, it's not like Google connects to
No, it's connected to many national and regional data sets that have been contributed in there. The USGS is an active member in GEON, so there's a lot of USGS products that are available. Some people could use the GEON cataloging service without actually putting the data in. So all you really need to know is where the data are. So the cataloging service can tell you that, whether the data is in there or not. So really the trick is to have good catalogs. You don't really have to have all the data, but like Google, you have to have good catalogs. That's the secret. Does that answer your question?
I'm not clear exactly as the only member of the Google to want the GEON.
No.
Data out there.
No, that's not true. Many scientists have placed resources in GEON and were not members of GEON.
All right, but the GEON is not connected like a Google, the way as Google connected to the world and search. If I search in GEON,
it doesn't have access to a small set of data.
Rather than all the database.
Yeah. So what it needs is a geologically aware crawler that can go out and find all the geological data, geoscience data that's out there, that's in the public domain, and register it into the catalog. Yeah. That's a hard problem, especially avoiding the dross, the stuff you don't want.
That's what I'm saying. For example, the database I've been running for Alaska database running for 5 years, and I have no direct connection. If I go on GEON, I find my catalog.
Well, I think that shows two things. Firstly, a discovery service would be a good idea, discovery of data. But secondly, even if you can get on GEON, it's hard to find what you want. In these kinds of catalogs, it's very difficult to find what you want. And having found something that looks good, just like in Google, there are actually 50,000 things that look as if they fit your query in. You don't know which one you should trust. So there are all kinds of issues that are more complex, I think, when you're doing domain-oriented science than when you're searching for a string in Google. So there's some real semantic issues and discovery issues that haven't been solved. That's certainly true. And GEON and this kind of cyber infrastructure is all the weaker for it. But there are also good catalogs that have been contributed into GEON. So there are good data sets in GEON that you can get if you're interested in certain kinds of problems. It certainly doesn't cover Antarctica ice cores and that kind of stuff very well, but it does cover earthquakes in California very well. But there's some stuff in there that it's patchy. Yeah,
I guess I want to make myself the last question in the interest of time. I was wondering about the concept maps, because you had mentioned before that you had developed the concept maps for different kinds of map projections as a part of the curriculum, or could be used as a teaching tool.
Yes.
And I was wondering about the use of the scientific concept maps. For instance, Randy Keller's map,
mm-hmm.
He might want his concept map to be used for his students in order to teach them one way of thinking, or how to do analysis, or how to implement a project. Has there been discussion of using the scientist's concept map?
No, there hasn't, but there have been visionaries who, like you, have said, wait, doesn't GEON mean you can bring together teaching and research in more effective ways? Mm-hmm. And I think that's true. I think it's an underutilized idea at the moment, underutilized mm-hmm. aspect of this kind of cyber infrastructure. You have right there in your face a representation of the thought process of a famous geoscientist, maybe another famous geoscientist who doesn't agree with it. And now you can look at the data and the models of these two people and gain a bit more insight than perhaps you can into reading the paper. Or if not, more insight, then it's more immediately accessible. It's like having the articles that they've written broken down and parsed and easy to explore, mm-hmm. packaged up. Yeah, so you can search and find arguments and workflows. Yeah, that's a good question.
Well, Mark has graciously agreed to stay here for a few more minutes if you'd like to chat with him further. And Mark, we are giving all of our speakers at Geosciences Club caps to keep you warm when you're back in Chile, Pennsylvania.
I'll need more than this.
Posters.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for
Thanks, guys.